The lower the ratio, the better. EV-EBIT cap rate. This ratio is a twist on the EV-EBITDA metric. However, instead of EBITDA, we use EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes but after deducting depreciation and amortization. At my old firm, Huffer and Arnott, we used to call EV-EBIT a cap rate, similar to a cap rate used to value real estate. We used to argue, why buy a piece of commercial real estate with a 6% cap rate or a bond with a 7% yield if you could buy a business like Macy's with a 20% cap rate? For financial companies and banks, I use some of the following. Price tangible book value. The tangible book value, TBV, is equal to the book value minus intangible assets such as patents and goodwill. Assuming the loans on a bank's balance sheet have been appropriately accounted for, a big assumption considering the events in the financial industry over the past several years, a bank trading around its TBV would represent the value at which one could theoretically liquidate the bank. The TBV per share, therefore, might provide somewhat of a floor for a bank's value. P.E. ratio. Tangible common equity total assets. This ratio provides a measure of a bank's capital adequacy. The more tangible common equity, the less leverage is employed and the safer the bank is. How many stock names do you end up with after you run your screens? About 200. I also come up with company ideas by reading and talking to friends in the industry. What do you read regularly that is helpful? I read the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and a number of subscription-based newsletters, including Wall Street Transcript, Dick Davis Investment Digest, Grant's Interest Rate Observer, Value Investor Insight, Santangelo's Review, and Form for Oracle, which provides data on insider sales and purchases. I also use two members-only websites that share investment ideas, Value Investors Club and Sum Zero. Two other useful websites are Vickers Stock Research, which tracks institutional holdings of individual stocks, and Thomson Reuters, which both aggregates brokerage firm research and provides transcripts of company presentations at conferences and quarterly earnings calls. These transcripts can be particularly useful. I will often read through a transcript more than once looking for upbeat or downbeat comments or signs of evasiveness. Finally, I review SEC filings, 10-Ks, 10-Qs, and proxy statements, and FDIC bank call reports. How do you go from a list of possible investment candidates, your screen list supplemented by the ideas garnered by reading and networking, to selecting actual investments? Then the real work begins, which is the qualitative assessment. What do you look for in the qualitative assessment? The first thing is that an easily understandable business. I focus on companies I am familiar with, what Warren Buffett calls investing with a circle of competence. I avoid difficult-to-understand industries with short and unpredictable product life cycles, such as biotechnology and high technology. I look for good businesses. A good business is one that provides a necessary service or product and has a balance sheet and a cash flow that can sustain it through difficult periods. I also look for companies that other companies might like to acquire due to their market share, intellectual property, distribution network, or real estate value. After I have identified a company to research, I will then begin to read through any Wall Street research I can find, especially initiation reports, the reports produced by analysts when they first begin coverage on a company, even if the report is somewhat dated. I find these reports provide great background on a company and the industry it competes in. Frequently, these reports include some background on the company's competitors, as well as tables that compare the company's profitability versus its competitors. Several years ago, I found a company, Insurance Auto Auctions, IAAI, in this manner. I had been reading a research report on Copart, CPRT, a competitor of IAAI's, and found a table near the end of the report that contained CPRT's margins with IAAI's. There was a huge disparity between the two. Both companies acquired wrecked cars from insurance companies, stored them on their lots, and then auctioned them off live or through the internet to buyers including salvage yards and auto body shops. Although both companies did the exact same thing, IAAI's margins were much lower. After meeting with management and doing some research, I couldn't figure out any reason why IAAI's margin shouldn't increase towards CPRT's levels. In addition, the stock could be purchased for just over 5x forward EBITDA, and at better than a 10% free cash flow yield. I began to purchase the stock around $15 per share, buying all the way up to $22 per share. Within a year, a buyout firm, Kelso Incorporated, bought the company at $28.25 per share. The general principle is that when there are major discrepancies between similar companies, the profit potential can result in a takeover or be realized by the market. Then when the stock reaches a reasonable valuation, you sell it and move on to the next investment. Good ideas don't come that often, but the wider you cast your net through reading, screening, and speaking with others, the greater the likelihood that you will succeed in finding good ideas.
Can you think of a trade that didn't work that provided a learning lesson?
In late 2006, I bought Horizon Lines, which was a Jones Act container shipping company operating vessels primarily between Hawaii, Alaska, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. mainland. Under the Jones Act, all vessels transporting cargo between covered U.S. ports must be built in the U.S., registered under the U.S. flag, manned by predominantly U.S. crews, and owned and operated by U.S. organized companies that are controlled and 75% owned by U.S. citizens. As one can imagine, the Jones Act creates a significant barrier to entry in these shipping lanes, and as a result, Horizon Lines had a substantial share of the market. On the negative side, though, the company also had its share of debt, and a number of older vessels that needed to be replaced. My thinking at the time was that I was investing in a company that had a significant moat around it, and that it would generate a lot of free cash flow, enabling it to deleverage. I started buying shares in the mid-20s, and in 2007 the stock reached the mid-30s. However, it was about this time that Horizon Line's shipping volumes began to weaken, which caused the share price to decline, as did renewed market unease over the company's need to replace its older ships. I became concerned about the Horizon Line's ability to generate a meaningful amount of free cash flow, and without it, I was afraid the company's debt load could sink in. Fortunately, I got out above my average cost, and in the process, I learned another valuable lesson about the danger of investing in over-leveraged companies. The stock today trades at 24 cents per share.
I assume the best value opportunities arise in the most extreme bear markets. If you identify a stock as a buy in that type of market environment, how do you handle the timing of the entry?
No bells sound when things get better. I'll never forget speaking with the CFO of Measurement Specialties during the downturn that began in late 2008. A large part of their sales was to auto OEMs. When car sales in the U.S. and around the world plummeted, Measurement's customers chose to draw down their inventories instead of ordering from them and other auto suppliers. As a result, the CFO told me that the phone didn't ring for about a month. Their auto customers just went quiet. Unless I assumed that no one was going to buy a car again, I knew that the situation had to change at some point. The company had earned $1.20 a share in 2007. I began buying stock at $3.79 per share in April 2009 and bought it all the way up through the $7. I sold most of my stock in the $14 in early 2010, which was nearly triple my average entry price, but still far too early. The stock eventually reached a peak of $38.98 in mid-2011.
Many value stocks stay undervalued for a long time. How do you avoid the value trap?
Lots of companies screen as being cheap. I think that it's easy to avoid value traps. The trick is to stay away from companies that can't grow their cash flow and increase intrinsic value. If I think the business is a melting ice cube, like newspapers, yellow pages, and video rentals, to name a few bad businesses, then I won't invest in it, no matter how cheap it is. Conversely, if I invest in a business that can be purchased at a discount to its intrinsic value, and that value is growing, then all I have to do is wait and be patient. As Buffett says, time is the enemy of the poor business and the friend of a great business.
Do you hold stocks for a long time?
It depends on valuation. As long as the share price doesn't get too far ahead of a company's intrinsic value, I will maintain the investment.
What has been your average exposure?
I'm mostly long. Typically my longs are between 30 and 90%. My shorts are usually less than 10%.
How have you managed to keep your losses so small with such a long biased exposure, given that we have had two huge bear markets since you've been running the fund?
I watch various economic statistics, including more esoteric data such as weekly rail car loadings. When the data points to a slowdown, I might reduce my exposure. If I am concerned enough, I may even move to almost all cash. This attention to economic indicators helped me in 2002 and in 2008, although in 2010 the same cautionary approach cut my profits. I sold a number of stocks on the notion that the economy was in trouble, and then the Fed initiated QE2, that is, a second phase of quantitative easing, and stocks took off. I was up 13.3% net in 2010, but I would have been up a lot more if I hadn't liquidated in response to my concerns about the economy. I have no regrets, though, because I'd rather miss an opportunity than lose money.
During the long bear market in 2000 to 2002, did you have low exposure the whole time?
I had very low exposure, and I was very patient.
How low?
I was almost 90% in cash.
For the whole bear market?
For most of it.
When did you cut back your exposure dramatically?
Around the end of the first quarter of 2000.
That's right at the beginning of the bear market. What prompted that timing?
It was mostly a matter of valuations being very stretched.
When did you get back into the market?
In late 2000. I thought we had a pretty good washout and valuations were more compelling. Then in November 2000, I had my worst month ever. I lost 6% and I went back to mostly cash.
Was it just the large monthly loss that got you back on the sidelines?
I think so. I don't like losing money.
How long did you stay mostly in cash?
Probably till early 2003.
What was the all-clear sign for you?
It was a combination of the compression in valuations and signs the economy was improving. I was hearing from a number of companies that business was picking up.
What was your experience in the 2008 bear market?
I took my exposure down, but not nearly as much as in 2000. I was approximately 60 to 70% cash.
Did you have any emotional response to the market meltdown?
I try to keep emotions in check. Having a lot of emotion about investing doesn't do you any good.
I guess you had pared down to a point of comfort.
I just kept on doing my research and focusing on what I knew worked, which is valuation. Certainly in that time period, I also wanted companies with good balance sheets.
You have been very successful in keeping your losses small. Is there more to it than just going to cash when the environment is uncertain?
It's also the type of companies that I buy, companies with good balance sheets and solid free cash flow. I'm always trying to buy a dollar's worth of assets for 50 cents, which helps limit the downside.
How do you decide where to get out of a position?
It's valuation driven. I wait till the stock is fair valued.
Do you ever hold profitable positions beyond what you consider fair valuation?
No. I've made a lot of mistakes doing that over the years. For example, holding on to a position for a full year for tax reasons and then giving up profits I would have locked in. You want to stay true to the investment process. When I buy a stock, I identify the difference between what I think it is worth and the stock price. Once the share price closes the gap, I sell all or most of it. I sometimes hold on to a small residual position and move on to the next investment. That might take a year or it might take a month.
What personal characteristics have allowed you to be successful?
I tried to stay as unemotional as possible when things go against me.
What is your advice about investing in stocks?
You need to always keep in mind that stocks are units of ownership in a business. If you buy a stock at a good valuation and the price goes down, unless something has changed with the business or business outlook, you should stay the course or possibly even buy more. Conversely, don't get carried away if the stock goes up. You should use the same valuation discipline to decide where you're going to sell. If the stock reaches what you think is fair value, take your profits and go on to the next one.
Wouldn't staying the course, let alone buying more, be a dangerous prescription if we are in a bear market?
That's different. I was talking about price fluctuations in a single stock. I know how to analyze companies. I don't know how to analyze the economy.
Why do you think you are managing so little money when your return/risk is better than most equity hedge fund managers?
That is an easy question to answer. I'm a lousy marketer. I've never actively marketed the fund. I prefer to look for good investments as opposed to new investors. Also, at my current level, I can make a decent living without the headaches that come with building a larger firm. When I was on the sell side, I used to be responsible for hiring and supervising analysts, and I never enjoyed that quite as much as looking for companies to invest in.
Claude Debussy said, "Music is the space between the notes." Analogously, the space between investments, the times one is out of the market, can be critical to successful investing. Despite being primarily a net long equity investor, Daly achieved cumulative gross returns in excess of 800% during a 12-year period when the broad equity market indexes were essentially flat. How did he do it? Well, of course, superior stock selection was an important component, but it is not the entire answer. Not being invested, that is, being primarily in cash, during negative environments is the other part of the answer. By not participating in the market at the wrong times, Daly sidestepped most of the large drawdowns in equities during two major bear markets, a crucial factor that underlies the large growth in his equity. Sometimes, being out of the market may be nearly as important to success as the investments made. Whether you are a value investor, as Daly is, or use some totally different investment or trading approach, the critical lesson is that it is important not to be involved in the market when the opportunities are not there. A corollary to the ability to be out of the market is the importance of patience to successful investing. You need patience to stay on the sidelines when the environment is adverse to your approach or when opportunities are lacking or suboptimal. Think of the patience it required for Daly to remain largely in cash well over 2 years in the prolonged 2000 to 2002 bear market. Daly's stock investing methodology and philosophy can be summarized as follows. Stick to business you understand. Find companies in those businesses that are undervalued via the pertinent metrics or similar competitors. Take profits when prices move up to fair valuation levels. Sail into a cash harbor when the market seas turn stormy. Stick to the basic process and never take flyers. Treat investments as a business, not as a gamble. Daly has one important edge that is also shared by virtually every reader of this book, small asset size. Daly manages only $50 million, which is small by fund manager standards. This smaller size allows Daly to range broadly across the capitalization spectrum, including companies that would be too small to trade if he were managing several hundred million dollars, let alone billions of dollars. Some of the best opportunities have come in these smaller cap issues. Daly fully understands the advantage of managing smaller assets, which is one reason why he has made virtually no effort to raise additional assets. Individual investors may feel they are at a major disadvantage to large hedge fund managers, but they actually have an important advantage. Their small trading size allows them to move in and out of positions, even less liquid equities, with virtually no market impact. The larger the assets, the more difficult it is for a manager to enter and liquidate positions without incurring significant slippage costs. Also, as the assets managed grow, the universe of possible opportunities shrinks. For large hedge fund managers, many markets and securities cannot be traded, simply because the size at which they could trade these markets and still have adequate liquidity is too small to have much impact on their portfolio, and hence not worth the bother. Although some managers have been able to maintain performance with large assets under management, I have also seen many managers who did very well while trading smaller asset levels, but then experienced significant performance deterioration when they allowed their assets to grow beyond the optimal level for their methodology. For managers, the discipline to turn down additional investor assets when they believe it would impede their performance is an important element in longer-term success. Chapter 14. Jimmy Baladimas. Stepping in front of freight trains. Jimmy Baladimas breaks all the rules. He sells into uptrends and buys into downtrends. He adds to losers and cuts his winners short. He is a predominant short in a market that is up the majority of days. By any of the standard guidelines for trading success, Baladimas shouldn't survive in the markets, let alone thrive. Yet he is one of the most successful traders at First New York Securities, the prop trading firm at which he began his career 15 years ago, and he has never had a losing year. I first interviewed Baladimas on February 22, 2011, a day which the equity markets were down sharply in a sell-off that ostensibly was triggered by the uprising in Libya, which led to a sharp rally in oil prices
and market concerns over a disruption in oil supplies. The Libyan upheaval was part of the domino effect of Mideast unrest that began with the overthrow of the Tunisian dictatorship a month earlier. This down day in the stock market followed a 3-month period in which the price advance in equities had been so unrelenting that neither the S&P 500 nor the NASDAQ index was able to go more than 5 days without setting new highs in the ongoing bull market that had begun 2 years earlier. The current month had been particularly brutal for shorts, as the market reached new highs almost daily, never taking more than 3 days to do so. Baladimas had been net short throughout this move. Watching the succession of near-daily highs, Baladimas commented to his trading assistant, "This is like the tech bubble, only with real stocks." Baladimas's trading assistant was my son, Zachary Schweiger. It was Zachary who made me aware of Baladimas and his incredible trading skill. Zachary was amazed at how Baladimas could be short a rising market and still generate profits. More profits, in fact, than many other traders in the firm on the right side of the market. Describing his boss, Zachary said, "Jimmy has zero fear. If he ever has a small position, it is either because he was right on the trade right away, or because the market has not yet moved against him. He has the same even emotional response whether he is up or down for the day." I caught Baladimas on a very good day for him, a day he had just made back more than his entire loss for the month to date. But had I not known he was short, I would never have guessed it from his laid-back demeanor. There was no sign of the excitement or euphoria many traders would have expressed after such a rapid favorable reversal in the markets. I am sure if I had come one trading day earlier when his equity was setting a new low for the month, Baladimas would have been equally even-keeled. I had arrived about 25 minutes before the close, expecting to silently observe Baladimas from the sidelines. In my email to him the previous day, I indicated I might arrive a bit before the close, but that, of course, I would not expect to begin the interview until after the close. I was aware that Baladimas was an active trader, and I did not want to get in the way. Immediately after I arrived, Baladimas began talking. The interview had begun before I realized it had. Baladimas made no further trades while I was there. I had assumed this absence of activity was because Baladimas had already placed all his intended trades for the day. Zachary, however, later informed that Baladimas had stopped trading simply because I was there. Not surprisingly, given the market's largest daily decline in many months, it had been an active day. "We placed about 500 trades before you came," Zachary said. "And if you were not there, we probably would have done a lot more. That's just the way Jimmy is. If people are there, he will pay attention to them and not the market. Chalk up another one for rules broken." I interviewed Baladimas at his trading desk with his 6 trading screens, a sea of red quotes as a backdrop. I found the room uncomfortably warm, but Baladimas was dressed in a heavy sweater.
"You have been short this market?"
"It has felt to me like the market was ready to come down for some time. Even though I held that view, I've tried to maintain some level of discipline, recognizing the market was quite strong. I was still net short every day, but until this month by only 5 to 10 million. That is the type of number that I can manage to not get hurt by too much, even if the market is up 1% or 2% for the day."
"But you are more heavily short now."
"Yes, coming into today, I was 15 million long and 41 million short. I got a lot bigger on Friday afternoon."
"For almost any other trader, that would sound like a strange statement. To put it into context, last Friday was a day after a long string of days in which the market was up almost every day, with no corrections along the way. The close was near the high of the week, the high of the month, and for that matter, the highest level in recent years."
"Something was happening last week that seemed different from the rally before then. The market had been grinding steadily higher, but the fact that it was so easy for the market to go up last week let me know that something was up. Thursday, the market rallied sharply after being weak in the morning. Then Friday, the market got really strong again near the close. The market was moving up like there was no supply. Coming on top of the large gains we had in the past 4 months, I thought, now the market is getting stronger? Now?"
He says this emphasizing the repeated "now" in a tone of incredulity at the sheer preposterousness of this price action, a tone that communicates, "Give me a break," without saying the words. The move felt fluffy to me, and
I honor all the senses I get. It just seemed like a logical place for me to get more short. I try to formulate my own ideas by listening to what the market is saying. Sentiment is one of my big clues as to what is happening.
How do you judge sentiment?
There are lots of different ways to gauge it. I watch TV, I read the paper, I listen to what people at the firm are saying. People are afraid to short. I'm not shorting any more stock. I'm tired of losing money. I heard that last week. I don't have the speed I used to have. I'm not a sniper anymore. I used to be like lightning, always moving. I don't move as fast anymore. There are things I do differently now. That's part of my evolution. Maybe I am a bit early, but if I am early, I don't get bigger just because I think I'm right. There are a lot of things that I have changed. Even though the market has been straight up this year, I'm still net ahead. I have made more money than most guys who have been net long for our firm.
How can you still be ahead when you have been wrong on the market?
I have some kind of knack for it. I don't know exactly what the knack is. Maybe it's being comfortable in situations where everyone is nervous. I always take some money off the table when the market is in my favor, regardless of whether it is a lot or a little bit. Even if the market is down only 0.5% or 1%, and I think the market should be 10% lower, I'm still taking money off. That saves me a lot of money, because when the market rallies, I have a smaller position. That is a habit I have had since day one. I always take money off the table when it's in my favor. Always, always, always.
But this past month, the market has hardly been down.
It's been very limited. I have been short an average of about 15 to 25 million this month. I have probably taken about 20% of that position off every morning that we were down in the first 30 minutes. Whatever is red, it doesn't make a difference what the symbol is or whether the stock is down only 50 cents or a dollar. I am taking some off. It is almost mechanical. It is sort of like my internal program that I do regardless of what the news is. If the market then goes up again, I am reselling the same 20% of my short at prices that are maybe 3% higher than where I covered. So the average share price on my shorts goes up. But it is a lot of work. Going along with whatever the market is doing doesn't make sense to me, and I have to honor that. I have made money every year in my career. Even though my system is flawed, I'm not entirely disciplined and I give myself too much leeway, it has still worked for me.
How did you develop your trading style?
My firm has always given me a lot of latitude, which allowed me to stretch my boundaries. While it was uncomfortable, it helped me learn how to make and lose money without being scared of doing either. I learned by trading a lot all the time. I traded more than anyone else at the firm. That is how I got my feel for stocks. I really felt them. I felt, oh, something has changed. I don't know what it is, but something has changed. I really trusted that feeling. What was interesting to me early in my career was that I would get a thought about what would happen and then be surprised when it did happen. It always appeared on the screen to me. It always showed itself to me. A stock reveals itself to me when something changes.
How do you see it?
It's a sense I've developed, and I have learned to trust that sense. I think I have spent as much time in front of screens watching the nature of stocks as anyone else in the business. Because I have watched these same symbols for almost 15 years, they almost take on a life of their own.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by sense?
I'll give you a great example. Tyco went from being one of the favorites on Wall Street to one of the Wall Street disasters in a very short order of time. I started buying at $34, and in a few days it went straight down to $18. My average price was around $23. I was long 750,000 shares and down about 5 million on the trade. I remember my boss coming over to my desk and asking, "Jimmy, what are you doing?" I said, "Don, I'll take care of it. I know what I'm doing." No one was talking because everyone knew the size of my position. I took over the entire desk position on the stock. Even though the stock was collapsing, I really believed, this is my opportunity. I don't remember the exact price, but I said to myself if it went below that price, I would have to start liquidating. It literally traded right at that price and stopped going down. At that point, I had a sense that something had changed. I didn't sell a share until the price was $1.50 above my average price, which happened that same day. I sold one-third of my position that day, and the next I sold the rest of the position about $3 or $4 higher. Then it went straight down again. I ended up having the biggest month of my career. The stock always seemed to reveal itself to me, especially when I have a large position and I'm watching it closely. What I have learned to recognize over my career is that I don't have to be early because I almost always see it. Maybe it's my lack of discipline that gets me in early. I want to be in early just in case I don't see it, but yet I've always seen it when it changes. It's a feeling, it's a sense. I think, why did I go early again? Here's my signal. I don't get it every time for every stock, but I get it pretty often.
Tyco ultimately went even lower. What gave you the confidence to buy it when you did?
It was just a feeling.
Was it sentiment related?
It was completely sentiment related. It was the velocity of the fall that got my interest. The price move from $27 to $18 probably happened in about 2 hours' time. That was when I bought a lot more, knowing that this was an all-out panic and an opportunity.
If it had gone below your price, would you have scaled out of the position or liquidated it all?
I never buy or sell anything at the market because I'm wrong and have to get out. I've never done that in my career. I'll begin to work out of the position, and if I see it turn around, I'll get back in again, thinking that I was right all along.
So you have never had a position that made you cry uncle?
I have had a lot of positions that made me cry uncle, but I don't capitulate.
Zach speaking.
Jimmy never panics. When we had the flash crash, his first question was, is there something wrong with the data? It took him about a minute to realize the price quotes weren't wrong, and he went long everything right there.
Jimmy continues.
I don't let myself panic. Even if I don't know what's going on, I'm not going to sell. I might lose 5% more trying to find out what is going on, but I'm not going to make a decision because other people are choosing to make a decision out of emotion. I'm not going to be that guy. There was one exception, though. I had to throw in the towel on my short position in home builders.
Was it a good decision that you covered your short position?
Yes, I was much too early.
When did you get bearish on the current market?
I remember in September 2010 saying to Zach, wow, the market is going up here. I should be long stocks. After the market rallied, I started going net short in October, and then at the end of the month, the market started to rally really hard. In November, I realized I had to adjust my position. Instead of covering my shorts, I started buying a lot of more longs and value stocks, which started to catch in November and December, and that helped me a lot. In December, I made back most of the money I lost in October and November.
But you were still net short.
Yes, I haven't been net long since September.
Even though you thought the market was going higher.
Because it didn't make sense to me that it was going higher, so I just reduced my short exposure by buying longs. The way I looked at it, the more the market went up, the more right my short was going to be. The more it went up, the more money smart people would take off the table. Smart guys always sell when the market is going up. That's how they make money. I'm not trying to prove I'm right. I'm not trying to prove the market is stupid. I just like making money. There are so many guys I've seen in my career who do something just because someone else is doing it. That is a way of getting beat up. I believe I have as good a sense as anybody in the market. I trust that sense, and it has served me well.
Was that sense there from the beginning?
Yes, that sense was there early on.
Do you think it is innate?
Yes, part of it is innate. There's no question about it. My goal is to one day be able to match up my trades with my sense that it's ready to happen right now and to only invest at those times. For me, mastery would be knowing that I don't have to be early
and all I have to do is wait for when I see it because I almost always see it.
If you usually see it when the time is right, why do you frequently initiate the trade before you get that feeling? Wouldn't it work out better if you waited until you had that strong conviction that now is the time, rather than anticipating the trend change before that point?
100%, no question about it. Sometimes I am the adult in the seat, and sometimes I am the child. If I am the child, he just wants to be involved. I'm not a computer, and I have many flaws. Sometimes I just want to be involved, and I get in instead of waiting until I see, oh, there it is. It's a lack of discipline that I have been contending with my whole career. Even though my track record would indicate otherwise, I still have some lack of trust in my process. I still want to be in the market early just in case I don't see it.
So even though you usually get a strong sense when the market is ready to move, you almost trade like you don't have that skill. Does that make sense to you?
It's worked in that I have improved my discipline. I don't allow myself to get bigger if I am wrong early. Even though I think I am right, I won't necessarily short more because it is higher. When I was younger, I would get bigger just because the market was going up. Now I'll wait till I get that sense that the market is ready to move before I get bigger.
When did you first get interested in the stock market?
My very first influence was probably seeing the movie Wall Street in high school. My senior year of high school, I worked for a stockbroker who was also the branch manager. In Williams College, I took a one-month course taught by Simon Long on trading and capital markets. Simon was trading for Bear Stearns at the time. He had a trading setup at his home, and I would go there almost every day. Simon was a really smart guy and a bit eccentric. He just loved talking about the markets. He really brought the markets to life for me. Also, I wanted to make money.
Was it the money that appealed to you in the movie Wall Street?
It was more the action that appealed to me. I'm a high-energy guy. I thought that trading perfectly fit my personality. My desire to make money was more influenced by my parents being immigrants who worked very hard. Those were my key influences. There wasn't much more to it. After college, all my friends went into banking, but I knew I wanted to be a trader. Even though I didn't know exactly what it was, I knew it was what I wanted to do. I interviewed with some larger firms like UBS and Societe Generale, and then one of my friends told me about a small firm called First New York Securities. I interviewed there, and Don Ehrenberg hired me.
Do you know what got you the job?
I don't know what got me the job, but several years after I had started with the firm, I brought my mother in to meet Don. In their sit-down conversation, Don told her, "I don't know what you did to your son, but I never had anybody work so hard. I knew I wanted it more than anybody else. There was no way I was not going to make it. I always had that competitive drive, whether it was getting into a top college or competing in college sports."
What did you learn about trading at First New York Securities?
I was an assistant for a year, same as Zach is. I learned how to follow positions in a daily P&L. I was fascinated by how the stock market moved and how money was being made.
What was the trading style of the trader you worked for?
Eric had a style similar to the style I have. Buy companies when they are out of favor and sell companies when everybody loves them.
It sounds like you came into this business as a contrarian.
I was introduced to that style of trading very early on, and it made complete sense with the way I looked at the world. Fidelity and the other behemoths that run massive amounts of public money are only buying what's good at the time. They're never going in there when Apple is dislocated or Exxon is dislocated. They're always selling then. The smart guys are always on the other side. That's the game on Wall Street. I'm not complaining.
How much did they start you out with?
I don't remember the exact amount, but I remember that I made $350,000 in my first year, $800,000 in my second year, over $1 million in my third, and I never looked back.
Did you ever use fundamentals?
No, never. There was a 3-year period when I had fundamental analysts working for me, but I found it very difficult to match up their views with my timing. I trusted my own work much more. It was a distraction. Fundamentals were not something I wanted to commit more time to. I wanted to spend my time mastering my discipline and focusing on what was going on with me emotionally that was causing me to make certain choices. That is where the real curiosity was for me. Trading is a great mirror into myself. It doesn't make any difference how much money I lose or make. I'm not going to be sad or happy.
What did you do to be successful from the start?
I was totally focused on trading. Nothing else mattered, not my health, not my relationships.
What was the first time you took a large loss?
I was short home builders during their big rally. I felt something was wrong. I didn't understand what was going on. Eventually, it became obvious that momentum hedge fund buying was driving the market. For the first time, I began doubting if I knew what I was doing. I lost about $7 million in 1 month. Losing such a large amount of money in such a short period of time opened the door to allow other questions to come into my life. That is when I started focusing on my health. I remember thinking, this is going to take me a year to make back. I made that money back in about 2 or 3 months. I don't remember how I did it.
What made you so bearish on home builders at the time?
I remember at the time people flipping houses and making money immediately. It felt very unreal to me. It was the way people talked about the home building sector. It was a new paradigm. Every time I have had a major concept, I have eventually been right, but sometimes I am too early.
I assume you were also negative on technology in 1999.
Yes, it's always driven by the nature of how something is advancing. It never made sense to me how something can move so much in such a short period of time. It didn't make sense that everybody had it wrong before then, and all of a sudden there's a whole new way of looking at it. Intuitively, it didn't feel right, and I honor that intuition.
Given your style of anticipating tops, how did you avoid disaster during the internet bubble when it was commonplace for stocks in that sector to go up tenfold or more?
I traded the technology stocks rather than the internet stocks, but they still had crazy moves.
Were you early?
Absolutely. But what was different in those days was that even if a stock was in big up move, you could get an opening where the stock was down $4, and then it would go back up. But because the stock would open sharply lower, it would give you the opportunity to make money off the table, and then you would have dry gunpowder. What has changed in the last 5 to 8 years with hedge funds becoming the main players is that there are far fewer pullbacks. Now you can't be too early. The last 2 years, April 2009 to March 2011, have devastated the shorts as much as any other time I've seen, even including the internet bubble.
Has that forced you to change your style at all?
Absolutely. It has forced me to rely more on the trust that I will see the transition point so I don't have to be so early.
How were you positioned when the stock market topped in March 2000?
I was short, but I didn't pressure the short. As it was going down, I was covering.
So you were taking money off the table as the market went down?
Yes, but I was shorting the early rallies.
But you didn't continue to play the downtrend in the tech stocks, which lasted for 2.5 years.
I didn't milk the down move. I am not a milker. For me, it was a question of what's next. There is never a shortage of themes. The market is always creating many bubbles. There is so much opportunity all the time that you never have to get yourself into trouble. You never have to be early, but I always have an inner conflict. There are certain periods where I get more obstinate because I think I'm right. I am more rigid than I would like to be. I think I am an exceptional trader, but sometimes I let my strong beliefs get in the way. I am working on letting go of my beliefs and be the trader I can be.
But the beliefs get you on the right side of the market.
The beliefs have always kept me making money and not playing the short-term moves that I don't really trust. The markets are such a greater fool's game. I don't want to be the greater fool. There is clearly ego there.
I understand why you may not want to play the momentum trade when it is contrary to your beliefs. But why not wait on the sidelines until you get the sense that the time is right?
Zach interjects.
Jimmy has this amazing execution. There are days when the market is up 5 or 10 handles and Jimmy may be $10 million short and he will still finish up for the day. And I can see that if he had not done any executions, he would be down $150,000 for the day. But instead, he'll end up being $30,000 for the day just by constantly trading in and out. We did 520 orders today. So when Jimmy is short and the market is up, he is not necessarily losing.
Jimmy speaking again. That's the point. Regardless of my belief that the market will fall apart, even when the market gives me just a 1% or 2% move, I'm still taking chips off the table. That way of trading explains a lot more of why I've made money in my career. It was not so much about my being right on the direction of the market, as it was that when they were giving me money, I was always taking it on a daily basis.
So even though today was only the first day of a down move, you still took money off the table?
I took half of my capital off today. If the market bounces, I will short the rebound for sure.
If the market bounces, that's easy. You just replace the short you covered. But what if the downtrend you were anticipating continues tomorrow?
If it's lower, then I will just be buying back more stock. I don't mind if I miss a move down because the market will always have a move that I can re-enter if I really feel like it. I'm never afraid of missing anything. The market is always providing opportunities.
So it doesn't bother you if you end up getting back in at a worse price than you got out?
All I think about is making money, not being right.
Zach speaking to Jimmy.
Something that you said has always made sense to me. I never need to make money in a stock where I lost it.
Jimmy continues.
Early in my career, I had more of a tie to stocks. Now I couldn't care less where I'm making money. I don't have any vendettas.
Anymore. He laughs. But you used to?
Yes, for sure.
How did you learn to give it up?
I just got tired of fighting. Losing all that money being short home builders was the biggest blessing because it led me to looking at my life in a different way. Why am I making my life so much harder on myself? It could be so much easier. There is something wrong when I start feeling that uncomfortable. Whereas before I would dig in my heels, I'm not willing to go there anymore. Now when a trade feels painful, I start reducing my exposure. I am much more sensitive and conscious about how I am feeling. If a position doesn't feel right, I will make the shift. I can't sit with that feeling very long anymore.
What is a recent example of when you had that type of feeling that something was wrong?
October 2010. The markets were starting to accelerate up and I was losing a lot of money. Even though the market had been going up for a year and a half, it shifted into a higher gear. I didn't like the way the market felt.
You sound like you are a natural short.
I am a natural short because there is a hype, a marketing campaign that is always at work to get people to be long stock, and it's unnatural. It's an energy that can't always be maintained.
The trading approach you have described, a strategy of selling stocks when they are up and buying stocks when they are down, hardly sounds like a recipe for success. In fact, it is easy to imagine how the approach could be disastrous. So obviously there is more to what you are doing. Can you put some color on it? How do you do what you do? Can you provide some specific examples of how you pick and time your trades?
I divide stocks into those that I'm looking to buy and those that I'm looking to sell. Then I recognize when those buys or sells show up in a way that suggests there is a possibility for an accelerated move in a short period of time.
How do you recognize that point?
Something changes. The chart could change. Something could happen within the group. There is something always changing where clues are given to me along the way that shows me it's time. For example, Goodyear was one of the stocks on my buy list. The other auto parts stocks had broken out a while ago, but Goodyear was lagging. We had been watching it for a long time. Then about 2 weeks ago, there was a day before the earnings report when the volume was huge and the price was picking up. I said, I think this is our spot. Goodyear's ready. I had been watching it for 6 months. I had always had a small position in it because the other auto parts stocks had phenomenal moves. I thought the Goodyear should catch a bid at some point. When I saw something change, I knew the stock was ready.
What changed? Volume?
The volume was incredible on an up day. I knew that one day I would see a change, and that was it. I believed that sense, and I went long.
Any other examples?
He scans his trade pad and then brings up a chart on one of the screens. Here's another example. Dollar General. We bought it right around here.
He points to the chart at a spot after a sharp downtrend with the price having fallen to near the low end of a longer-term price base. What was the rationale for that trade?
Retail stocks were going up. We were looking for some value in retail. The stock had sold off 7 points in a month and a half.
What is this big upside gap?
I refer to a price move on the chart that occurred a little over a week after the trade entry.
there was a takeover.
Once the takeover was announced, did you get out?
Absolutely, it was a 15% move.
Baladimas continues to bring up price charts.
MU, Micron Technology. We had been long all along, but we got much bigger on this day here when the stock was up a lot and broke out of a band. Although it had been a big move up that day, it was still in the trading range it had been in for a few years. The stock had broken out of the trading band of the past few months, but was still within a broader long-term trading range. So I wasn't chasing the stock. I felt comfortable with it. I wouldn't feel comfortable with something like this.
He brings up the chart for FFIV, a cloud computing company.
I would never buy that stock.
The chart shows a long, nearly unbroken uptrend, followed by a huge downside gap not far from the high, and then a rebound about two-thirds of the way back to the high.
This is a stock I would short. Tomorrow, if the market is up, I will probably be a seller.
Why specifically are you so negative on this chart?
It is a broken stock. It broke on big volume. The indexes have made new highs, and the stock can't get above its 50-day moving average. All the investors have been riding the stock all the way up. Although cloud computing is a great story, it is overplayed.
Current prices way outstrip any growth potential for the next few years. Analysts are talking about 2015 numbers. It's ridiculous. No one knows what's going to happen 4 years out. It's difficult enough to forecast the next quarter. The rhetoric buildup is always a similar pattern. Here is another one. Amazon broke down here, and I went short on this day.
The Amazon chart is another long-term uptrend with a big downside gap that occurs not far below the high. The day Baladimas points to is on a subsequent partial rebound back toward the high.
Why were you bearish on Amazon?
Because of the chart. The price had almost doubled in a year. The big volume on this down day showed me the turn was for real. I didn't go short that day because the market was down $20. I waited until the market rebounded above the 50-day moving average. Amazon still went up another $12, but then I doubled up near the high.
The rebound high was in the vicinity of the previous high,
because I still thought I was right and I did okay. Here is Chipotle, a wild stock.
I look at the chart, and it is another large uptrend.
If I look at a stock and it's in a large uptrend, I know you will be talking about the short side. The short side, right. I got caught in this whole thing.
Baladimas points to the last segment of an accelerated uptrend.
You stayed short the whole way?
The whole way.
We doubled up here. Baladimas points to a spot on the chart closer to the high of the up move. So we brought our average price way up.
So you doubled up into a deep losing position?
Into a deep losing position, but knowing it's Chipotle. They sell tacos. It's not like it's some new technology company. I'm not going to be that scared of it. The tacos may be really good, but the stock has gone from $140 to $270 in 3 months.
Really?
I don't care how good the tacos are. I got out here.
He points to a retracement on the chart.
So I recovered about three-quarters of the loss.
You seem to do a lot of selling into uptrends.
Yes, but I am always buying it back on the dips. And you hope to get lucky sometimes and get a big down day. That just happened to me in cotton. I was short the cotton ETF, and on those 2 days I lost $200,000.
He points to a chart with another big uptrend, with a near-vertical upmove on the last 2 days of the advance.
I was short 7,500 shares, and on this day I added another 22,000 shares.
He points to the high day of the move.
I saw there was huge volume. I said, this is a squeeze. I don't care what's going on in Egypt. The stock has doubled. I should take my shot here. Call it luck, call it what you want. The stock was down 12% the next day. I ended up making net $100,000 on the trade. It was la-la land. The ETF could easily have been up another $10 on the next day. That's where the chutzpah comes in. When no one else wants to do it, sometimes there is great opportunity.
There are days like today when the cash register rings, but it seems like your trading style is one that must place you in discomfort on most days.
Yes, because the market is up more days than it is down, and I would guess that in my career I have been short about 75% of the time. But I wouldn't say it's discomfort. It's pretty much of the routine.
It seems like the only time you are with the trend is when you are betting on a reversal and then the market turns around.
I'm good at catching the early part of the trend. I'm trying to learn how to catch the middle part of the trend better. I am never there for the last three innings, the capitulatory phase.
The interview has carried on for 3 hours, and Baladimus's energy seems to be flagging. I suggest perhaps it might be best to finish the interview on a second meeting. Baladimus readily agrees. I return about 3 months later, May 24, 2011. I begin our second conversation with a line of questions about parts of his strategy that just don't make sense to me.
It seems to me that what you are really skilled at is trading around a position. In fact, you are so good at it that you often make money on a position even when the longer-term trend is against you. It's like you are really good going upstairs quickly, but you are often going up the down escalator. Wouldn't your performance improve going up the up escalator? If you traded around a position going with the trend instead of against the trend, wouldn't you do even better?
Here is a good example of why I don't have any trust in doing that. Recently, silver had a historic run on the upside. I had been eyeing silver for 6 months. Technically, it was in a bullish pattern. In commodities, more so than in any other asset class, most traders take the trend. Nevertheless, I thought the market was a short. I watched the market for 6 months until I thought, it's time to sell this thing.
Did anything happen on that day?
It had a reversal, but it was the build-up up to that point that was important. The silver price had nearly tripled in just over a year. The precious metals markets were spooked by the University of Texas taking delivery on $1 billion of physical gold. There was news on TV every day about inflation. I'm seeing all of this and thinking that they are really pushing the story very hard. It felt like everybody was buying silver. Those are the opportunities I look for. I went short the silver ETF.
The prior price move up had already been parabolic, and then the rally became even more vertical. There was real money being put to work in silver. If you saw the amount of volume trading in those last 4 days of the up move, it was clear that it wasn't retail investors. It was institutions saying they had to be there. The big volume told me that supply was coming into the market. I doubled up during that rally. The market made a new high, and within 3 days I was down $4 million on the trade. It was already cuckoo land before that rally, and I knew the market was an even better short, but I had already used up all my ammunition. I wasn't willing to bet my year and have to make back $8 million if the market had another move like it just had over the past few days. It wasn't worth it to me to put myself in that position. The market then sold off to about my average price, and I covered the position. On balance, I probably about broke even, and then the market quickly dropped down to $32 from its high near $49.
But you had covered the whole position.
Yes, because I was tired. I may not have made money on that trade because I got too big a few days too early, but my point is that my way of looking at the world is right. You had every expert tell you how much silver was worth, and yet it went down from $49 to $32 in the biggest market sell-off in over 30 years. I went maximum short within 4 days of the market top. I trust my radar as to what is really happening in the market. So when you ask me if I should change my style, maybe I should be more flexible. But I don't have the trust to buy a market in a trend, the way I trust my instincts on a trade.
I wasn't asking you why you didn't buy silver at $30 or $35. I understand that totally. And actually, if you tried doing that, I think it would turn out badly because it is so counter to everything you believe in. But I'm asking you something different. Earlier in the up move, there is a point when you think that this market is eventually going to set up for a good short, but you only watch it because you think the trend still has a way to run. At that earlier juncture, why not participate on the long side until you think the market is getting closer to a point when it is a sale? In other words, I'm talking about going long well before the market becomes parabolic, let alone vertical.
I am good at catching the turning points, but I'm not good at staying in a market when the streets get behind it. I'm always early. But the analysts and the people who run most of the money on Wall Street are never going to put their necks out there. They're waiting for the trend to be really intact, and they are trying to catch that middle portion of the trend, which is the juiciest part of the ride. I catch the first part of the trend, which is the hardest part. I'm getting better at extending it, but I am not there for as much of the ride as I should be.
Here is what I don't get.
It seems that in all the price moves where the market is in cuckoo land, as you term it, once the market finally breaks, it usually keeps on going. Why participate in only the first few weeks of the new trend when these types of markets will run at least 6 months to a year or longer once they turn? Why trade